I'm Bronwyn Williams, futurist and trained analyst, and this is Local Logic, where we help South Africa's technology leaders unlock the real power of data and AI in their technology stack. Join me as I sit down with Dr. Bongani Andy Mbaso, CTO of Altron Group, on building secure data and AI-driven digital transformation. Local Logic, a technology podcast brought to you by Altron, because local expertise drives global results. Welcome back to Local Logic, a technology podcast for leaders brought to you by Altron. I'm Bronwyn Williams, and in this continuation of the last conversation we had with Dr. Vivian Ming and Dr. Andy Mbaso, Chief CTO of Altron, we are going to explore why most AI adoption fails, how employees outsource thinking instead of co-creating, and what you can do about it as a leader. We're going to get practical and explore how Altron chose the right tools and built the right culture, and what Vivian's research reveals about courage under pressure. Let's pick up where we left off. Back to you, Andy, but I want to add something else to this broader conversation. Assuming, and that's a very big assumption at the moment, teams are able to get this right. You've hired people who are willing to think, smart people. You've put them together into teams to go and find and address and interrogate these ill-posed problems. But they take their responsibility too seriously, and now they're actually using all the technologies available to them to go and solve those problems. And now we start running into rules, regulations, and quite frankly, the law. So if you just log on to LinkedIn, you can see some IT or, you know, CTO manager just complaining about how they walked past a cubicle and saw some junior employee putting customer records into an open source LLM to try and get an answer. So they're solving the problem, they're being proactive, but there's rules in place. And there's all this risk that comes from empowering our employees. How do we find a balance then, Andy, between giving people access to the tools and to the people and to each other to solve the problems we need to be solved and to create the problems we need to create so that we can keep on moving things forward, but still having governance, still obviously understanding that organizations operate within a legal framework, and even if the law is behind, it exists. And governance is an issue that's increasingly now being attributed to individuals. There's been a whole lot of shifts in terms of signals of how countries and governments are governing organizations and making responsibility for usage of tools, for usage of technologies, responsible not just to boards or to the non-human entity, but to individuals. So how do we limit our risk without going back on all those very valuable points we've just covered today?
Yeah, Bronwyn, I can feel you pulling me back to the practical. I could get lost in this conversation with Vivian because I think it's fascinating, and that's kind of the future. Yeah, I'm trying to raise my children in that way. It's difficult, but I think it can be done. But to bring it back more practically, and I'll use Altron as an example. You know, why did we select Claude? Mm-hmm. Well, the first thing that we did is we had an AI policy, and we had to write down what is it that we can and can't do as an organization, given the markets that we operate in, the laws. You know, we're in South Africa, we are a South African domiciled company. What does the law say? We've got a policy that's very similar to GDPR. It's called POPIA, which protects both personal information and entity information. So there's definitely things that we cannot do, right? So we had to sit down, really look at the regulatory landscape, look at our policies, look at our objectives as a business, and go, right, if you're going to adopt AI, this is the scope within which we can adopt it. So that's the first thing we did. The second thing we did is we got our chief security officer. I said to him, I said, hey, Alvin, can you just tell me on any given day, what are the various tools that people are using? So we actually went, looked in our network, and we found, can you believe it, over 150 tools that people are using every single day. I mean, okay, fine. Can we use AI to help us understand all of their various policies? Which ones would potentially contravene, you know, this policy that we put down? And of course, there was a whole, you know, bunch of them. 80% of them got kicked out. There was a few left, you know, say about 20, where we went, yeah, okay, maybe, maybe not. Maybe with approval, we could let that go. And that's how we narrowed it down to Claude. I'm actually quite excited that last week, we've actually opened up Claude to the whole organization. So every single person in the organization can use Claude, and they have to go through training to be able to do that. They have to understand it's a tool. It's there to help you own the problem and solve it all the way yourself, right? I want you to present the solution to me, not your AI. So that's the approach that we took within Altron. And I think that's the practical approach that we advise in our customer base as well. You have to understand what is your business? What is your regulatory landscape that you operate in? What are your policies? Who are your employees? Who are your customers? All your stakeholders, and then come up with an AI policy and then choose tools and enablements that fit within that. Because you're right, there is still a practicality, to this. In your personal capacity, try everything. I have, they've just announced Gemini 3. I've got the new IDE already. I've already coding with it. They've got Gemini 3 Pro already. I've got everything. But when I go to work and I have to deal with that information, it's Claude, because I know that their policies and the policies that we've chosen for ourselves as an organization and as a country, the regulatory laws, they kind of fit very well. So I hope that can act as a bit of an anecdote for how, others as well can follow a practical step-by-step approach to choosing the right tools.
Let me note on that practical, and I'll keep it brief. Two things. When you're talking about doing trainings, keep in mind, we're not just, if I can keep with the language, we're not just talking about training the well-posed. How do you deal with the unexpected? How you're confronted with some sort of a roadblock, and it'll be easier to go around in a slightly less ethical way, but maybe you don't perceive it as such. Getting training in truly how to solve ill-posed problems is worthwhile. And it feels like, oh God, do I got to take this employee offline and go through some complex training? No, because one thing, it needs to be real problems anyways. Mm. So I'm a strong believer, and I have a lot of research here as well, role modeling. Find people that are doing this amazing well in your organization. Create opportunities for people to work with them. Highlight what they've done well. Don't keep it hidden. Someone, particularly engineers, kind of hidden behind their screens, who knows who's doing this right and who's doing it wrong? Probably the wrong stuff is sneaking around the office in, I found this way to get around the system. But the right maybe isn't spreading as fast. Highlighting those amazing stories of people going the distance to do the right thing and getting an amazing result as a result of all that effort, that's really important. So there's storytelling, there's role modeling, and there's training for the ill-posed, not just the well-posed, to really extend out those, I hope, practical, but just saying, push the practical outside the easy and be inclusive of what's hard also.
Thank you. That's actually leading up to exactly what I wanted to get into just after this, which is straddling this line between ethics and efficiency and knowing when to sort of stretch the borders of the definitions of each, because sometimes the rules are the wrong rules and they need to be challenged, especially with new technologies. We can't apply, 1900s copyright law to the current environment. It's no longer fit for purpose. And sometimes laws and rules and regulations, not just talking about the actual legal infrastructure that will send you to jail, but the corporate governance that we have in place or our institutional governance that we have in place might not be fit for purpose. And I don't know, Andy, if you've got any ideas as a CTO of a large organization with international footprint, how are you navigating that? How are you navigating as a CTO now having to step into that role of actually leading what legislation, what governance, what ethical rules, as well as sort of just those legal rules should and perhaps could be going forward, those guardrails? How do you balance that?
Yeah. Look, I think firstly, you won't be able to do it on your own. Every now and then, the regulations, and it's not all the time. It's not. Fortunately, most of the time, you can well operate within the laws of the country. There are just generally no challenges. Where there are issues, I think the best way to do it is to engage with the policymakers. And we find the best way to do that is to engage, as a collective. Because if you go as just Altron, I have this specific issue, it's very hard to change the policy makers' mindsets. And so to go as an industry, maybe represented by an industry body, we find is very helpful. And actually, organizations are very good at this, right? Many organizations have, you know, somebody that looks after regulatory affairs. You just realize that actually the role of regulatory affairs has now changed to include how do you interact with the regulators when it comes to AI, right? And how it impacts your organization. So in many ways, organizations have been doing this. But I think that our regulatory affairs officers don't often see themselves as that conduit, right? To have that, those conversations from an AI policy perspective. Within the organization, you have to keep an open ear. You know, like, Vivian said, there's, you know, it's often very difficult, to hear something that's contrary to the status quo. You know, so if an employee goes and says, this does not work because of 1, 2, 3, my immediate reaction is to shut it down. Because you are a rogue employee, it's, you know, it's kind of, you know, you come going out, coming out of line, get back in line, go back and do your work. And I think that's part of the human skills that makes us, I suppose, different and special to machines, is that I can explore to go, well, what if what they're saying is correct? What if this policy is hindering progress? You know, and I can imagine, you know, ways in which we could integrate a new possibility into the organization. That's how we got to, you know, adopt Claude. It wasn't, you know, I made it sound so easy. It wasn't without convincing a lot of people because it was breaking out of the status quo, right? It's like, it's this startup in America. Why do you want to use their stuff? There's so many other players that could do 1, 2, 3. And so you have to kind of break out of that a little bit and paint a picture, right, of a new possibility that people can start to buy into. I don't think that I have a practical step-by-step guide, unfortunately, for this one in terms of how to do it. I think it is just part of, you know, just you being open-minded around, you know, something that you don't, you know, perhaps know.
And then, Vivian, I wanted to try and square this very wonky circle that we have drawn today as we almost run out of time. And that is coming back to the question around values as well as value of technology. And here I kind of want to ask you the converse to the question that I asked Andy, asked him about when rules are perhaps ill-fitted for the future or for the present reality that we're living in, and when we need to reassess what we think we know when it comes to guardrails. But here it's the other point, and this is, when does ethics need to enter the chat? When we're talking about there are no rules to play with, why is it important for individuals, for organizations, for teams to have their own ethical guardrails in place? And I spent quite a lot of time working with some of our larger banks earlier this year talking about this, especially as a lot of the carrots and the sticks around things like climate, environmental responsibility, gender responsibility have largely been diluted, if not entirely dismantled in the global context. Organizations and individuals have to choose for themselves if their values have a price that they are willing to pay. And what is your kind of advice here when it comes to using technology specifically, ethically, even if there's no legal requirement or overt economic incentive to do so? I know that's quite an unfair conversation. We didn't invite you to talk about AI and ethics. So I thought you might have a comment there.
Yeah, so I've got a couple of posters behind me. Obviously, there's my upcoming book, Robot Proof, but I have another book I'm writing called Small Sacrifices. And in that, I talk about two experiments I had the chance to run. And they're kind of bookends, addressing exactly what you're talking about. These were both done with large multinational organizations. Yes, I am dumb enough that my philanthropic work, I often do for giant, massively profitable companies. If it's an interesting question about humans, I'm interested. So in this first one, what we found, to keep it very brief, is people had this self-image that we were looking at up-and-coming executives, highly educated, highly motivated, global young executives. And what we found is we could get them within half an hour to an hour to do things they themselves had identified as morally wrong. And not only that, we could get them to do it, and afterwards they would come up with complex reasons why it was the right thing to do, how they were mistaken at first, and they needed to change. And when you finally get this book, as I'm sure everyone will buy all of these books as soon as they're available, what you'll see is in that chapter, I talk about cognitive load and emotional load and the social neuroscience of your medial prefrontal cortex and nucleus accumbens, like, yeah, yeah, yeah. But essentially, I scared them. When they got scared, they started choosing the things they themselves was wrong. They became their own villain. And yet, in retrospect, the only way to square that was to redefine the problem, to say, no, I was wrong at first. They weren't. Now I understand this was the right thing to do. And almost always they said it was the good business decision. That's really terrifying, to see how quickly a fundamentally good person can make a terrible decision when they become scared, when uncertainty dominates and they are not prepared to deal with uncertainty. The bookend to that is this other experiment, also with an even larger organization, where we found the single biggest predictor of untracked productivity inside the company was something very nerdy. We call it second order or higher order productivity. People who made other people better. And who were those first people? It was about 11% of the employee population of the company, accounted for 80% of this untracked productivity, and they simply helped other people. That's it. It sounds like, how could that be? It was that simple because 70,000 of them allowed us to track them in real time. We got to see what they did. What's the psychological factor that defined those people who, as the title of the book implies, were willing to make small sacrifices throughout their day, even though it didn't obviously help them personally? They were driven by a sense of purpose. They had something in their lives that was bigger than them. Those people don't crumble under the pressure of uncertainty. Those people do the things that have to happen to move projects forward, even if those things are hard. When you look at those two stories together, you realize how all of us are a little fragile. And you also get a sense of the roadmap to how to address that fragility, to be humanely anti-fragile. And my line I sometimes use on stage is, we aren't simply courageous. It isn't in our genes. We aren't just built this way. Yeah, there's a lot of variability between people, but fundamentally, courage is something you practice. And if you're not practicing being courageous, making hard choices when it's easy, I promise you, you will not be who you thought you were when the choices are hard. When you're scared and things are uncertainty, the very thing we've now spent an hour saying is the job of humanity, dealing with uncertainty, you will become the person that makes the wrong choice. And you don't have to. Practice courage. And for you leaders inside organizations, train people, reward people, tell stories of courage. Again, checklists are nice. It's an easy thing to fall back on. But fundamentally, these are messy human traits, and we need time to get good at them, to prepare for when things are really challenging, including the fundamental courage of going to your boss and saying, I think that this is wrong, and here's why. And having that conversation. Both sides, the boss needs the courage to hear that, the employee needs the courage to come through, and you need to build the company culture that allows that conversation to happen.
I think that's a great way to pretty much wrap this up. This might be a technology podcast for leaders, but ultimately it's all about people and what we do with the tools and technologies we have available to us that are now, in a very literal sense, allowing us the powers to be gods or monsters or both of our own creation. And Andy, maybe you want to come in with a final comment to assure people that, or to inspire or to scare people a bit further when it comes to this conversation, and what perhaps the most important thing for leaders to take away from the future, looking to how to lead organizations and teams through this certain technological uncertainty that we're all facing ahead.
Yeah, I think I would say to not be afraid to fail. Often failure is a bit of a barrier. And if you punish it within an organization, people will be very, very predictable. They'll do the thing that was done last year, and then the thing that was done last year was done the year before that, et cetera, et cetera, and your company becomes stale. I would say that you need to, you know, find, and maybe I'll steal a bit of Vivian's language here, which is, you know, teach a culture of courage, so that I am not afraid to fail, because in my failures, I get to learn some lessons and I can figure out how to do things better next time. I don't think in a world where information and facts are becoming commodities, you can afford to be scared people. Because how do you build the next great thing if you don't have any courage, right? Like the easy pickings in many ways, they're finished, right? Like LLMs have all these easy pickings now. So you have to be courageous to move forward. So I think it's a beautiful way to
If end. You want a truly provocative statement that I'm going to give no explanation, you just have to know I'm always right about everything. In the optimally intelligent organization, the majority of people should be wrong the majority of the time, productively wrong, exploring. Have you built that culture in your organization?
Well, there you have it. So go forth and do the hard things and ask the hard questions. This is Local Logic, a technology podcast for leaders brought to you by Ultron. And thanks so much again to my guests, our regular, Dr. Andy Mbasso, and our special guest for today, Vivian Meng.
Thank you, Vivian. I'm looking forward to your book. I am going to read it.
I am looking forward to never having to think about writing a book again, and yet I have two more in the hopper waiting to come out.
Local Logic, a technology podcast brought to you by Ultron, because local expertise drives global results.